Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. It's time for the QLP Poetry Reading Series. This series is designed to showcase the works of poets from around the world. The host of the program is Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Good evening, everyone. Again, this is Michael Anthony Ingram welcoming you to QLP Reading Series. My very special guest tonight is Bill Cushing. Bill recently published a new book, A Form of Life, as well as a chapbook, Music Speaks. Bill, are you with me?
Oh, I certainly am.
Great. Why did you publish these books?
Well, of course, A Former Life was the one that just came out. Actually, Music Speaks is still in the works, but hopefully going to have that out pretty soon. I wanted to get the stuff assembled and see if I could do something with it and, you know, see if there's sort of self-validation, if you will. I mean, is my stuff worth putting out there? And so I'm happy to have been able to get it, you know, picked up by Finishing Line, and they put it out, I guess, last June. So,
all right. Well, what was an early experience where you learned that poetic language had power?
Well, that's, and it is funny, because I do mention this in everything I talk about when I talk poetry, is that I actually came to it sort of through the back door, in that I wasn't even thinking of it. And at the time, I was on my college newspaper, and I went to a big journalism conference, and the woman presented a workshop on how to improve your writing. And essentially, she said, hey, you want to make your writing better than anything, start writing poetry. And then, you know, she just talked about the idea of compacting the language, is, you know, getting as much use out of each word that you can, and, you know, the discipline of it. I kind of like that. And so that sort of started me, and then I got hooked into it, and now I've been doing it. Well, that was 1988, I guess, and so I've been doing it now for this last few years.
You know, when you think about poetry, so often we think about emotions. Do you think that someone could be a poet if they don't feel emotions strongly?
Well, I think I don't think all my poetry is emotion. I think a lot of it is images, too, but there's the emotion, I guess. I always liked, there was a woman, a photographer I knew in Florida when I was living in Jacksonville there, and Frances Driscoll was her name, and I always loved what she said. She says, you know, to be an artist, you've got to be, you have to be of two personality types. You have to be sort of sensitive enough to be attuned to what's going on around you and find what's worth commemorating or, you know, putting into your art, and then you've got to be thick-skinned enough to have people criticize it. So, you know, if you're going to get into this game, be ready, because you're going to have to be of two minds at times.
Now, do you read your book reviews?
Yeah, I do. I've been very pleasantly surprised, actually. I think the funniest I've seen, of course, I had a student when I was in Puerto Rico teaching high school. One of my students is now living in Spain, and you know, he picked up the book, and then he wrote me later. He sent me an email and said, "Hey, look, I have a friend in England who writes poetry. Would you, you know, I'll pay you and pay the shipping, and would you send him a copy?" I said, "Oh, sure, absolutely." So I sent it off. Well, it turns out the guy has a blog in England. And he wrote a review of the book and gave me some very kind words, I thought. I mean, it was funny because he says, look, I'm coming at it as a Brit, and so my sensibilities are a little different. But, you know, so I don't, you know, latch on to everything that's there. But, you know, certainly he said, you know, it's a worthwhile book. And I was like, oh, that's really great. I think the funniest part, though, was that I'm trying to remember the woman's name. There's a woman who runs a blog post and she does reviews, and she gave me a very good review too, I thought. In fact, she wasn't really impressed with the earlier book that I'd done with Chuck, The Notes and Letters, but she said, oh, this is a, you know, a big improvement over it. I think mostly because of the thematic elements that went into this book, whereas the Notes and Letters is more a playlist for us when we perform. But I had to laugh because both those reviews came out about the same time. And what was it? He said something about, well, some people might not appreciate the overt Christianity that goes into the last few poems in the book. And her review said, well, you know, the Christianity is a theme, but, you know, it's a fairly bitter theme. Well, apparently neither one of them got it figured out. So, keeping everybody on their toes, I guess.
What for you is the most difficult part of your artistic process? What's most difficult?
Oh, gosh. I guess, well, here again, I think any time you have to take criticism, especially when it's something you really like, that becomes difficult. I guess the hardest thing for me is finding the proper form for whatever I'm trying to write. And I think that's where I play around the most, where I'll try something. For example, I try a sonnet that just doesn't work that way, and so I have to back up and say, okay, I still want to write about this topic, but obviously it's not going to fit this format, so I got to find another way of doing it. But I don't find editing difficult. I just find it challenging and trying to find, you know, what's the right way to do it to get the most effect out of the piece.
All right. You know, now a few technical questions before we continue. What piece of advice would you give to your readers about your work?
About my work?
Yes.
Well, in particular, I always loved when I was at the University of Central Florida when I was doing my undergraduate work. I always loved that all my classmates there in the writing classes called me the blue collar poet, which I said, yeah, that captures it pretty well. I'm not highly academic, even though I've been teaching in, you know, colleges and stuff for 20-something years now. But I don't consider myself. In fact, I always like to tell my students, like, look, you know, I'm not that mysterious, so it doesn't take much to figure me out. So I think that's the biggest thing is I'm more caught up in trying to capture the moment for as many people as I can. And I think that was what I'm always going for. In fact, one of the guys who reviewed the book before it came out, Christian Golson, who's now, I think he's out of Arizona these days. No, he's in New Mexico now. The guy's all over the place. But I always liked what he used to say. He said, you know, I want to be able to show my work to both the professor and the cleaning lady and, you know, have them both come away with something. And I always liked that.
I'm always
trying to do that in such a way that you don't have to be. It's nice if you are, and obviously I do have some images coming from mythology and history and what else, but I always like to make it as simple as possible, too.
All right. Where can readers find your books?
Well, actually, now they're on Amazon, and then, of course, Finishing Line Press is the publisher for the former life, so they have it available through their website as well. So you can get it either way. The new one I'm working on, Music Speaks, will be, and I'm hoping in about 2 weeks to have that out. I think I'm pretty much done with it. I'm waiting for the final copy to come through, what I hope is the final copy. And that is, I'm actually self-publishing that through Lulu, but it will also end up being on Amazon as well.
And tell me about
that
Music Speaks.
Been,
yes.
Well, that's been a lot of fun because it actually was the, I entered a, for National Poetry Month this year, the San Gabriel Valley Poetry Festival had a chapbook competition, and I entered it in that because, of course, music is a big part of my writing. It's You know, a lot of my poems deal with music and musicians and that kind of thing. So I sent this off, and it, you know, I was very happy to see it did take the prize.
All right.
And I said, you know, I like the material there, but I want to do something more with it. So what I did was, and actually I did send it out to a couple of publishers, and there was a publisher in England that wanted to pick it up. But when I looked at the contract, I said, you know what? They're taking too much control of the creative end of it, you know, in terms of the production and the typesetting and stuff. And I said, I know what I want it to look like. I'm just looking for somebody to put it out there. And I'm thinking, and then when I looked at the, you know, as far as the compensation for it, I was like, well, I can probably do better myself. So I'm just doing it on my own and self-publishing it. And it's kind of I like to say I'm trying to make it a blend of both chapbook and kind of a coffee table book almost. With, in other words, I have pictures associated with the poems there, with the different performers. Not all of them, but you know, as many as I could secure the rights to. So it's an illustrated book of poetry in many ways.
Right.
Which, and I think it's coming out pretty well. In fact, I noticed you threw the front cover up.
Yes.
On the site there. And actually, that's even been through a few changes, nothing major, but a few minor adjustments on that cover. And in fact, that's what I'm waiting for is the last one. I made some adjustments to the back of it. But I think it's pretty much ready to go. So I'm hoping I'm supposed to have that, you know, latest copy in hand in about a week and a half. So as soon as it gets here, if it looks good, I'm going to go ahead and start releasing it and advertising it, figuring, well, Christmas is coming.
Yes,
maybe I can get some sales there.
Yeah. Well, question for you, how can readers stay in touch?
Well, probably the best bet, actually, in fact, I have the Notes and Letters Facebook page. But also, my email is pretty easy to remember. It's PiscesPoet@Yahoo. In fact, that's what I'm doing now. I'm setting up promotional stuff for this book and saying, hey, you got any questions? You know, shoot me an email at that email address. But, you know, it's like I said, it's all one word, PiscesPoet, and at yahoo.com.
Pisces Poet. Now,
yeah,
I know that you're on the cusp of publishing a new work in terms of Music Speaks. What else is in the works for you? What else is in the
works
for
you? Well, I'm sending out. I've got another one I've sent out, and I've got it at about three or four different places now, mostly contests. Another chapbook. I've lately gotten into the ekphrastic stuff, and there's a website out of Canada that I've been sending stuff to pretty regularly, and they've published a few pieces. So what I did was I put a book together. It's another chapbook. It's probably about 30, 32 pages long, and I'm calling it This Just In, and it's what is the subtitle? Is Poetic News, Fake or Otherwise, and going with that. And it's mostly the ekphrastic, where I've got the painting that it's associated with and the poem that came out of it or the picture. And then there's some other pieces in there that I thought fit the overall theme of it sort of being a newspaper of my life kind of thing. Although it's beyond that, too, actually, because a lot of the ekphrastic stuff gets into some very supernatural, otherworldly stuff. Which has been a lot of fun to play with. That's something I'm sending out pretty regularly now and seeing if I can get one of these picked up and published. And then I'm probably going to start working on a second assembly, you know, a full-length assembly book, mostly with the idea of I'm going to be, you know, retiring in February. And I want to get back to no thanks. but at any rate, I think I mentioned the last time we talked about the memoir I wrote about my late wife. And I want to get back to that, and it needs a lot of work, and I just don't have the time between my course load and taking care of my son and, you know, doing whatever else I want to do. So this way I can have the time to devote to some real hardcore editing, which is what it really needs. I've been working with this writing group now for several years, and every time I bring it in, of course, everybody just rips it apart, and I'm going, yeah, you're right. This stuff all needs to be changed. So it's such a major overhaul that I don't even want to try it on a part-time basis. I want to really devote time to it.
Well, but you're here tonight to share your work. I do not want to keep the audience waiting. What we're going to do is take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Bill Cushing. All right?
Thanks much.
Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Bill Cushing. So without further ado, I give you Bill Cushing.
Okay, thanks a lot. Well, I thought what I'd do is take most of the stuff out of the former life book and you know, do some of that. And I guess one of them that you're familiar with, I believe, is that at a mountain waterfall. And that's one of my Puerto Rican poems, basically. It was written about my time down there. And actually, I'm real pleased to say it just came out about 3 weeks ago, I guess. There's a foreign literary magazine or anthology that comes out every few years. And they were able to, they took that and a couple of other pieces of mine. So, yeah, this one's, and it's interesting because this is one of the few free-form pieces I do where there's not a real structure to it. But this is at a mountain waterfall. Water slaps my face, forcing my eyes shut as we climb crab-like, scuttling platform to platform along the rocks that form an opening not more than a half foot across. And from that 6-inch aperture, water shoots out and down. Rocks run in steps, handholds, some jut out with holes in them. Vines crawl down and nourished by water that splashes, runs, pounds and flows, begin to take root as they touch down on another base of rock. Holding a stone shaped like an axe blade, as big as my hand and as thick and almost as flat, except for one hard wart, at the broader end. Other men might have been here using rocks like this one, chipping them into tools and weapons. This island reminds one of all things primitive. And okay. So that's that one. One of the things, I believe, what was it? Oh, you were asking for that. You mentioned that girl in green?
Yes.
Yeah, which I always like to say is my voyeuristic piece. that one, actually, I noticed you posted that one up, I believe, on the site, which I always like to say it was my hat trick with Borsky Press. I don't know if you know those folks out of Virginia.
No.
Yeah, I managed to get a short story in there, and then I had a nonfiction piece, and then I rounded everything out with a third issue and this one. And this is Girl in Green. Hair bobs around a face of Nefertitian beauty. She sits with an arm draped over the arm of a chair. Her green sleeve bends from the stiff leaves of a potted plant shooting out of a clay urn. Another sits leaning against the wicker, resting her chin on a bended knee, her eyes closed and placid. The girl in green runs a hand through the shoulder-length hair of the other. I feel that hand scratch through my hair, the nails separating graying ends, the tips of her fingers resting as if on my skin. My neck cranes at the touch. End. And one of the things, and maybe just to move into, because this is certainly, it's in the form of life, and it's my poem about Miles Davis, which I've got to confess has been one of the pieces I'm proudest of. It's really given me a lot of mileage, I would say. It's in the new book with a couple of images of Miles. But I thought I would do that one, which is in, you know, both former life and The Music Speaks. But it's actually, the title is actually a quote from Miles Davis. And it's, "Music isn't about standing still and being safe. Listen, 2 weeks after you died, a 250,000 thronged by the St. John's River to hear the music you had spawned, hoping to see you, but even in death, you never looked back. They were all there, Hannibal, Bird, Chick, JoJo, Red, Jocko, Bean, Dizzy, my favorite, Freddie Freeloader. Isolated, you were a beacon, a flagship for messages of the heart. Back to the crowd, unbowed, that proud dance walk, announced by muted horn, that spoke and broke through all the bull and told us about a place. Miles ahead of everyone else, you spent a lifetime thinking for yourself, speaking to every generation, playing it all, jazz, blues, funk, rock, fusion. Categories took a backseat to creativity and rhythm, space and feeling, spirit. I remember fourth grade, picking up a horn, then laying it down. Rock and roll was my world. What did I know? 7 years later, I heard. It was in the garden where you brought me back to music. I walked all the way home, miles from that train station, my head pounding with sounds, frantic fast as the subway I spent the night on, those African rhythms you used decades before anyone else even thought to, filling my head, letting me know I'd have it all down cold if I could walk as cool as the notes you heard coming from. Miles, you had that thing, that style, that spark that was a blue flame jumping off a gas stove, igniting everything everywhere, touching the genetic resonant frequency in all." And I thought just to, I'm going to veer into that book, That Music Speaks, because this is another one that shows up in that. And this is one I really enjoy. And once again, it's not too far from you guys. It's about UB Blake, which I don't know if, are you familiar with UB?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Then you'll understand. For those
all
who
right.
don't, I always said, this is a man who did life absolutely right. And the name of the piece is Blake's Song. And it's all one word, just Blake's Song. UB did it better than anyone, not just music, but life as well. Sneaking off at 13, already pro, playing at a Baltimore brothel. He filled time for men lounging on couches, pulling slugs of whiskey from flasks, waiting for the girl of, if not their dreams, at least their choice that evening. Then people hummed his show tunes, but his true calling being the Rachmaninoff of ragtime. Long fingers doing what few can hope to, created perfect stops, gaps leading to rolling trills, rollicking dances on black keys, running along accidentals of flats and sharps. Later, I watched him play on that Manhattan stage as Alberta Hunter sang, both seeming unaware of the crowd gathered about them, he having a year for each key of his instrument, she 80, nearly two centuries of experience. I wasn't at a music hall that night. Instead, I stood on the edge of Mount Olympus, looking up, getting a chance to eavesdrop on gods of music as they played. And so that's one of the ones that's in the new one. What else? Well, I guess I should also, I'm trying to find some pieces that were in this. Well, one I particularly, and it's funny, I'm here again, very proud of this. When I first came up with the idea for this one, I didn't know whether it was going to be a poem or part of a story, but it turned out becoming quite a decent poem, I thought, and especially given that some people who have read it basically understood it right away, especially friends from South America. My wife is Peruvian, and this is based on an incident I noticed while I was down there visiting relatives of hers. And it's called Two Stairways. The first greets guests as they parade through the foyer to a sunken living room. The steps, wide with carpeted tread, ease along gilded walls, interrupted only by staid portraits of patriarchs. Lips brush cheeks, besitos de cultura alto, as the gathering elegant guests follow the living room past a massive dining room table where innocuous ceramic buttons, doorbell fixtures strategically placed to summon the help from the kitchen that hides the second staircase, steep, jagged, and above all concrete. Servants with rough hands wrapped in skin, darker than the mahogany furniture they rub to a high shine, trudge between floors carrying meals, laundry, lemon water, and imperceptible curses triggered by the buzzing commands. Worms of rage burrow deep into their hearts. And let's see. Well, this is, let me go to one of the religious pieces, why not? And it is funny, too, because here again, related to that, I remember when I was in school, workshopping some of my work. I remember one of my classmates asked me, she said, well, religion, are you religious? I said, well, not particularly. She goes, that shows up a lot in your stuff. I guess so, but I would say, I'm sorry, but there's some good material there. I'm not going to let it go to waste. And this one is actually sort of a takeoff on Milton's Paradise Lost, or more specifically, Paradise Regained. And it's called Apologia, which in the original Greek, of course, means a defense of. So this is Apologia. And it begins with the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I, a fallen spirit, made a forced exit. Ultimate love for him led to this downfall, this condition of torment I now lead. Heaven then was ageless, changeless, forever and eternal, as I was, still am. The law was laid down ages before man, before altars, before temples or churches, before the writing of law itself. Then that first commandment was altered and given to mankind. Trivial creatures created out of ego, then possessed by it. It is ego, not knowledge, that is original sin. Remember this, before you were, that command stood for all, animals, plants, even angels. But when clay and dust were mixed with the breath of life to become an impostor of their creator, then even angels were told, kneel before men. Now my temptations serve as testimony to man's worthlessness, proving his Bible and God's own words correct. The torture of souls is only an afterthought, only reciprocity of torment. For my refusal to bow, I suffer now, as do you. And that's that one. I'm trying to see what else. Well, this is, I think, yeah, you were mentioning this one, which another one I enjoy. I grew up on the water, basically. I was out of New York, and we lived on the, on Long Island Sound. And that's, a lot of my images, or a lot of my stuff comes out of that experience. And this one, the Pelican's poem, I always like to say, if there's such a thing as reincarnation, I'd like to put in a request. So this is Pelicans. Slowly circling, the pelican drops like a stone into water. Then climbing the air, he stops, and with a single motion of wings, glides on the wind. And I'm trying to see what else would be. Well, this is always, I always enjoy this. This is actually the first serious poem I wrote, which came out of, after that workshop I went to. Now I happen to see one of these places, and I think anybody who hears this will know what I'm talking about. It's called In Pink Neon. Chrome and black tile at breakfast again. Coffee is so strong it pulls your eyelids back going down. And while last evening's drunks with 5 a.m. shadows use it to try to face the new day, women, legs on spiked heels, lift leather skirts to reveal specialties of the house, initiating a physical negotiation, trading the tangible for currency. Enclosed cuffed hand, scaling triangle of whole wheat drips from sunny side up. A single waitress covers ground. Butter warmed by sun shining through slanted glass slowly rolls down a stack of brown pancakes. Silverware clatters, china against china. Napkin falls, voices chatter. While outside in pink neon, a sign glows, best food in town, and it is. And I guess, well, this is always, do you run workshops and that sort of thing?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, okay, because this is one, every once in a while, if I have to lead something, this is there's an exercise I love doing. It's a writing prompt that I think has really results in some interesting stuff. I've actually gotten 2 or 3 poems out of this, but this one may well be the best. And it's actually became part of an anthology of Southern California writers a couple of years ago, and I was very flattered by the fact that the publisher wrote me ahead of time and basically said, hey, look, I love this line in this poem. Can I use as the title of the book? And I was like, oh, are you kidding me? And so the anthology is called A Lullaby of Teeth, and this is the poem it came out of. And like I say, it actually comes from a writing exercise I did with some students that resulted in this. And the poem itself is called Alpha Dreams. The wolf bears fangs even when sleeping. Legs move in rapid dream twitches. Cheeks quiver from tickling branches that swipe his head. Leading the hunt, he chases with others of the pack. Sweaty fear fills his nostrils, and sanguine expectation tingles through his thighs. Nipping, then ripping at the flanks of a deer, they jump with him as one. Then the imagined pack straddles its fallen meal, dining without grace. A lullaby of teeth as enamel scrapes against bone, and the song of sinew stretching before tearing free from the cooling carcass fill his night. So that's that one. Let me go ahead and I may as well take a stab at the Chateau Forte La Riviere share, which, so for anybody who's listening who knows French, my apologies up front if I butchered the language. But this is actually, and this poem, I kind of like it because it really fits with, one of the things I'm always doing when I meet people who are involved in poetry is just as it's more of an exercise now is ask them, how do you define poetry? Because the best definition I ever heard, it did not come from a famous poet or a PhD or something. It was some guy I met on a train and we were talking, and he said, poetry is the history of the human soul. And I thought, yeah, that's a perfect definition, because actually, if you look at the original poetry from the Greeks, it was sort of the historical record of events for their, you know, for their history, mythology, whatever. And this one came out of, I read a story about this castle, and it just fascinated me so much that I came up with this piece, and it is, you know, everything you hear is true. So this is Chateau Forte, La Riviere, Cher. Paying the Loire tribute, Cher rises in the northwest, then flows across a plateau to join the Evre at Vierzon. 18th-century masons built the chateau from and on pilings of a 16th-century mill, creating a castle more squat than wide. Torchlit halls link galleries, ballrooms, the castle fastened riverbanks with black and white tiles, witnesses to minuets, waltzes. Then pawns cross the checkerboard that was then scuffed by the jackboots of soldiers of the Thousand-Year Reich, lasting only 12, a fraction of the Fuhrer's promises. Taking flight from Gothic weight, the structure offered flight to the builder's descendants. They had no way of knowing, these workmen who joined shores with stone, the path they left, placing this architectural bridge on arch columns. They spanned generations both backward and forward. They did not see events that were yet to be, yet still supplied an avenue to freedom for their great-grandchildren's grandchildren. And so that's that. And what else sounds good? I don't think I'd read this with you before, but this is one that actually came out of various places because of something I noticed. It's called Washington Street. It is always, it seems, an inner-city street, lined with warehouses, accentuated by cinder block projects, too concrete to induce dreams. Purple-painted cement patios seem to bend under maroon velour couches, filled with larger-than-life women fanning bandana-wrapped faces, while their men huddle around tables, drinking beer out of cans, and playing cards for chump change. A bus grumbles along, mixing diesel fuels with the exhaust of crack. Inside, a blue-tattooed ex-con tries seducing a woman in a seat nearby. She talks of Jesus, the afterlife, and her church. He promises to meet her there, although their theirs are at odds. Still, he prays for what might happen after dark in a consecrated park off Washington Street. And let's see. Shall I continue, I guess? Let's see. Well, this is, it's interesting, too, in a lot of my stuff, my father makes an appearance quite a bit. And, of course, my father was one of those guys who was larger than life. I mean, you know, just impressed everybody. And he was impressive. I mean, you know, he was very much ahead of his time on a lot of things. He was an electrical engineer who actually studied solid-state electronics back in the 40s before it even really existed while it was still experimental. And so he does make an appearance quite a bit. And this poem is actually, it started out about my mother, but it, of course, turned it out being about him. And the event that occurred did happen on the date I give. The poem itself is called Father's Day, June 20th, 2004. I watch my mother die over days, eyes sealed shut, glazed with a crust of time, occasional sounds pantomiming conversation, breathing barely there and marked with wearied effort, hands sprout from two thin and shriveled arms, laying wherever placed. Her legs scabbed from the falls of her last conscious moments. My father, the martial stoic, sits beside her, leans into her, and whispers in her ear, "It's okay to go if you wish," telling her, "I'm ready." In a half century of life, I had never seen such tenderness. His age-mottled hands stroke shallow cheeks. A half finger brushes back brittle hair. And while it took 3 days to complete, on this Father's Day, my father inclined to give my mother the gift of dying. And let's see. Well, what else might be worth looking at here? Well, this is actually, and it is a kind of an interesting choice, I guess. I don't know how conscious it was on my part, but I did end the book A Former Life, or Former Life, and the opening poem is called A Former Life. I mean, that's where the title came out of, was that poem. The final poem is called Final Flight. I slept through those initial collisions, the twin explosions as steel and fuel met concrete and girder, for the final collapse into rock and powder of two towers meant as monuments to the grandeur of their century. I saw it from a safe distance, not living through events except for my own recall. I can still note those, retrieve the day, but the singular image I cannot shed, the one that refuses to leave my head, is that of those people, the 200 left who, facing the option of burning alive, knowing at that moment they were indeed dead, chose instead, like Icarus, to spread their arms in almost welcome embrace of the quarter-mile journey back to Earth. And let's see. Well, why don't I, maybe what I'll do is divert back to the new book, The Music Speaks. Have I got time to do a couple out of that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. So let me go, it was funny because after the chapbook won the award, and I started putting this together, that was when both Leon Redbone and Dr. John passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote some pieces about them, and I threw it into the book as, you know, sort of playing with the idea of music. I call it an encore. So it's not part of the original entry that came in, but it was added to it. And this is the one for Dr. John. It's called So Long, Dr. John. Bid farewell to New Orleans' favored son after more than a six-decade run, infusing sound with flamboyant fun. We woke up to learn that Dr. John had folded his sheet music and was gone. He left us music, casillas bon, making whoopee with syncopated ease as hands danced and flirted across keys, taking us back in time, but now he's in the right place at the wrong time. He could make voodoo blues sublime like Mardi Gras goes on all the time. And then the other piece I would like to share with the listeners. This one comes out of the movie Pan's Labyrinth, which I absolutely loved, and fell in love with the music of it, of course. So I put a piece in about that. So it sort of incorporates the soundtrack or the score of the movie, along with some of the story as well, for anybody who's familiar with the movie. And the title of the poem is La Rosa y el Dragón. Terror rarely comes in thunder, preferring a sinister waltz of seduction, the single notes of a piano, Bartok-like, accompany the spiral stairs, winding down the maze, echoed by hammer-struck wire, blossoming out into chorus. Then a voice, like violin strings, descends in pitch, looping in carefully placed steps of a few seemingly random notes, walking up scales and back. This dance of timpani and plants follows the labyrinth as wind hums ethereal as an oboe, exhaling. A deep drop in tone, a bassoon, then metallic bones clash in clanging vibrations, while strokes of plucked harp strings, the heartbeat, first steady, then slowing to a perfect if ignoble end. Ophelia, hearing the lullaby, rests to find the peace of mind found in the art of dying. And so those are a couple of pieces from the book I'm working on now, The Music Speaks. So, well, I guess return to a former life. This is one, this was actually written for Gisela, my wife, and it's called Morning. Morning is my favorite time of day. Waking to an aroma of mangoes, your scent, feeling the weightlessness of curly hair. I can hear the easy rise of breath, a sculpted cheek and chin rest on my right shoulder, while the thumb and forefinger of my left palm lay flat, forming a V along the smooth cheek. Then, in a manner that would humble Helen of Troy herself, you rise, languid and liquid, and the lunar glow of your cool body moves into the light, casting a crescent shadow around your breast, your hips. Then your face turns toward me, and a smile spreads to greet the day. Then I rise with you. And oh, I guess it wouldn't be complete without something. Our son was, he's now 18, but still has a lot of work ahead of him. Our son was born with, he had suffered two strokes before he was even born, among a lot of other things that he's got going on. So, which I always like to say, he got his bad karma sort of out of the way up front. But this is a poem that I wrote about him. And I've got a couple of pieces about him, but this is the one about his birth. And it's called Gabriel's Coming. Things did not turn out as perfectly as we'd hoped. When the doctors extracted him from the womb, there he was, a twisted pretzel of a person, this child who was to be perfect, shaking and bloody as a wounded bird and not much different. From the bony shoulders, like broken wings, crooked arms splayed up to the curled hands that seemed jammed under a quivering chin, attached haphazardly to a crooked head. Hips perpendicular to a withered torso, legs running up the sides of a pruny chest. All these deformities from blood that had clotted in the brain, a stroke. So, a malady of the elderly became his personal anomaly. Blood-soaked, crooked, crying, and brain-damaged. This was how we greeted our son. Yet, from those bodily barricades and out of that unquenchable panic, came a boy who did not interrupt a family, did not join a family, but who created a family. And what else? Well, let me go ahead and I thought I was here, maybe not. Well, this is always a fun one. I always like to say this is my first official love poem.
All right.
It's it's about a guy who I'd never actually met, but I dated his granddaughter and heard stories about him, and she showed me an article about him, and so I wrote this, and it's called Clarence. After a lifetime of farming, tending land and animals, you retired. Replacing the rich smell of dung with the moist scent of sawdust, you took up hammer and chisel to become a carpenter. You said, half joking, it was the best way to stay out from underfoot. You told that to a reporter from Ames. He wrote that should the Grim Reaper ever knock on your door, you'd invite him in for checkers, providing he was neither a Democrat nor a Baptist. After serving coffee, playing a few games, death would probably leave a new customer. Like many carpenters, you lost some fingers to your craft, showing your heart was in your work, that sacrifice being more important than a few manual digits. And the heart shows in each finished product, the wooden bowls that came from a lightning-struck tree, the clocks all set 7 minutes too slow, or the stool you built your great-grandson, the seat heart-shaped, the legs shortened for smaller legs. And so that's sort of a sampling of what I got.
Incredible.
Thanks.
I thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. Thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. Question
so
for
much.
You.
Yeah.
What new information did you learn about yourself as a result of writing your books? What new did you learn about you?
Jeez. Oh, I mean, not that it's a great revelation, but how much I've lived.
All right.
I mean, it is funny because I do, like, the first, I actually divided the book into three sections, people, places, and things.
Mm-hmm.
And the people section is pretty much chronological, not so much in terms of the writing, but in terms of the different periods of my life. And, of course, the last poem being about 9/11, is also, a part of that as well. In fact, I did enjoy that the one review over the guy in Britain, he mentioned that even the places section is about people or their connection to place.
Yes.
But it was interesting because it was a way to look back. And I think anybody who writes, I think, is sort of doing that automatically. But certainly, I guess it becomes reflex when you hit my age. Is that's what you're doing, is looking back and, what have you done? Assessing your own life and what went right, what went wrong, and
what went wrong.
Sort of recording
so
it. But also, I think just having had the discipline to sit down and work through the project, I think was interesting because I've been, writing poetry since 87. I've been publishing it. Well, I had a certain amount of success in the late 80s, early 90s, or through the 90s. Then, of course, when Gabriel was born, that sort of took us away from everything for quite a few years because of the work that needed to be done with him. But then when I returned to it, and actually it was funny because I got back into it, I went to my 45th high school reunion, and it suddenly dawned on me, it's like, if you're going to get this writing stuff done, you better get going because you're running out of time here. So that's when I said, I really want to do this. And here again, this is why I want to retire. It's not so much that I don't enjoy the work, but it's like, I've got other things I want to get done. And this is one of them, is getting the memoir about my late wife out, another book of poems, hopefully. Maybe I started writing a novel at one point. I'd like to try and get back to that. In fact, I'm even still on occasion throwing out a chapter or so, kind of as a self-contained story, but something could be worked into it. I've got all this stuff I'd like to do. And it's like, you're damn near 70 here, pal. You better start giving serious consideration to sitting down and doing this stuff.
Well,
so,
you're serious. Thoroughly enjoy your work. And listeners, if you need a book for the holidays, I recommend highly A Former Life. I recommend
it
100%. It's a great read, and it touched me deeply.
Oh, thanks. And here again, I think that was one of the best reviews I had was one of my old high school buddies bought a copy pre-publication, to help me out. And the first thing he said is, you don't need to be an academic to read this guy's stuff.
Yes.
Like, anybody can. And that's sort of, I think that's kind of what I shoot for, even though I really admire a lot of, I look at some of the other people I know and look at their stuff. Geez, I wish I could do that, but I've got my own niche, I guess.
Oh, yes. Yes. And as we know, that when we compare ourselves to others, we always falter because they always seem to be better than what we think.
Yeah.
But as I share with people all the time, the grass is not greener, it's astroturf. So
I'll keep that in mind. There you go. That's right. Thanks for putting up with me here.
Thank you. I'm glad that you had an opportunity to share your work, and you're welcome on the program anytime you'd like to come back.
Well, great. Thanks so much, and I will keep in touch.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Good night,
thanks so much. Bye-bye.